y'all. It's Wednesday.
Hey.
As I always say, it's the anchor of my week. It's how I know what day of the week it is. Welcome back to 8Bits, our weekly show where we talk to super interesting, cool people in tech and talk about their path and how they got here. But before we do, we always do some catch up together. Brandon, I'm pointing the wrong way. Brandon, how you doing?
Sorry, I threw you off. Actually, we should probably do this. Oh! There we go. Now we match our logo. Right.
Whoop, oh, yes.
Right, yeah. Don't want to confuse anybody.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on that logo, perfecting it, making it look exactly like us. We've got to mirror it perfectly.
That's right. So if anybody's looking for some design consultations, we're basically experts now.
You
can see our beautiful work right here.
Yeah. Shout out to Ashley for making those beautiful, beautiful designs.
Yeah. But no, it's been a good week, Chloe. I mean, it's beautiful and sunny here in California. I feel bad for the folks in the rest of the U.S. because
it looks so chilly everywhere else. Oh my goodness!
Friends are just sending pictures of just snow and frozen everything. So if that's you, definitely stay safe. Hopefully, you're able to stay warm. But just hoping for the best. But in the meantime, it's beautiful here in California. If you want to,
it is. It's very strange to see so many folks without power, and it being so snowy. I'm such a California girl, of course. So I'm just over here on the West Coast, sending all the good vibes and blankets and everything. Gosh, well, what have you been working on this week, Brandon? I know you probably are doing some, let me guess, some .NET stuff, I would assume. C#, maybe?
How did you know?
I don't know, just a guess.
I actually put out a couple blog posts this week. They're, yes, all on .NET. There is a preview of Azure Functions running with .NET 5. And that is, we'll say, long story short, the team's been doing a ton of work. .NET 5 has been out for a couple months now. And Azure Functions was always tightly coupled with .NET. So it wasn't until they upgraded that we could upgrade our version of .NET that ran on top of Functions. And so we were always kind of locked in. But they've been doing all this work to separate that, break it out. They're calling it an out-of-process worker. And so I wrote a blog post on my website, codetraveler.io. Check it out. And it shows how you can use .NET 5 with Azure Functions. It's still in preview, but kind of a cool glimpse into the future because, yeah, going forward, once the team finishes this massive engineering undertaking, then any language, any runtime can run on Azure Functions.
Nice. Very cool. Azure Functions, everything, honestly. Like, I use Azure Functions for all the things, so that's exciting to hear. But
same.
I literally just tweeted before this, I need to think of some Ariana Grande-themed Azure Function. One of our wonderful MSAs tweeted earlier that they repurposed my Azure Function fake boyfriend project and repurposed it to work with an Android device, which is so cool. Oh. So there's Azure Functions all around us. But I need to make an Ariana Grande themed one. I've got a bunch of my friend made a Mean Girls Azure Function project with me recently. So I'm all about those Azure Functions. I'm so excited that .NET can come to the party now.
Very cool.
Yeah. I put a little link in our chat, Brandon, because speaking of Azure Functions, every Monday, I have been live coding from scratch with my pals Adrian and Lorena. Previous friend of the show, Lorena, our clown turn engineer friend. And we have been from scratch building a kind of a Twitch notification system. So basically using the Courier API and using Azure Functions, we are making it so you can sign up for notifications. So let's say, you know, someone really likes 8Bits, the show, but it's really hard for them to subscribe to notifications from the Microsoft Developer Channel because it would be like ding, ding, ding all the time. Always content happening on this channel. We could make it, Brandon, so people could just subscribe specifically to our show And they can get a notification of their choice, be it from email or Slack or a text message. So we're building that live on the air. We just built the first part, which is the Azure function. So you can check out the docs there to catch up on our week 2 content. But every Monday, come to my Twitch channel and Bit Project's Twitch channel and Adrian's Twitch channel. And we're building this fun little project from scratch. So other people can build it too. It's going to be completely open sourced. You can make it so anybody can subscribe to your content with the Twitch API.
And that's twitch.tv/week2bitcamp, right?
Yes. Oops. No, sorry. It should be aka.ms. Sorry. aka.ms/week2bitcamp. That's where you can check out the documentation to catch up on where we left off. So you can join us next Monday, and where we will basically be hooking it all together. So getting the Azure function that we built live on stream last week. You can check out those videos from last week. And then we're going to be connecting it with the Courier API, making a whole sign-in HTML page and stuff. So we're learning as we go. And people are literally, it's been so cool. People have been helping us debug in the chat. And like, I love live coding on Twitch because it's such an interactive experience. It's not just pair programming. It's pair programming with everyone. So you don't just have the knowledge of the 2 or 3 people in the room. You have everyone on the internet there to help you. So come join the party. Help us debug it.
Yeah, it's funny because I definitely thought, I felt like it was super intimidating when I first started coding live on Twitch. But everybody's so helpful and supportive. And the folks watching, they'll literally help you fix things and catch bugs before you catch them. It's just like, wow, thank you. It's so such a nice experience.
In a strange way, it's like having some of the best, brightest engineers in one room without sending any meeting invites or coordinating anything, because literally anybody with any level of experience can pop in and like help you with these things. And I think PJ and I recently were trying to figure out regex, because I always have to reteach myself regex every time that I use it. And by having other folks in the chat who are regex experts, it was perfect. So I'm just going to code everything out in the open now. Just crowdsource everyone's help for everything.
definitely for doing regex too, because that's tough. Thank you to everybody out there who knows regex really well, and that helps the rest of us that don't.
Yes, thank you for all the documentation and fun websites out there that I've used to relearn regex every single time. So, should we introduce our guest? Should we bring in our extra special guest for today, Brandon?
Absolutely. You want to kick off the intro?
Okay. So, I'm very, very excited for this guest today. They have been at Microsoft a very long time. They also have a lot of really cool, interesting hobbies outside of Microsoft. I think this is how I found this human on social media, on Twitter and stuff, because I love to see people who do really cool things at Microsoft, but also have a life outside of Microsoft, work-life balance, you know, that thing. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Ben Rudolph.
Woo! Hey, everybody.
Hi, welcome, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. Would you like to tell, I mean, we're going to go over your, as we like to call it, your origin story, your Marvel origin story, how you got here today working at Microsoft, but tell us a little bit about yourself. What is your job nowadays at Microsoft?
Sure. So I am the chief of staff for Microsoft Consulting. So Microsoft Consulting is this huge part of Microsoft, actually have about 10,000 people in the org. That's really focused on helping our customers accelerate their adoption of Microsoft technologies and help them envision the future. So we're not like a McKinsey that's really thinking about like hardcore business management consulting, nor are we like a HCL that's doing like IT outsourcing work and implementation. We are really focused on, you have a problem or an opportunity. There's Microsoft technology that can help you either capitalize on that opportunity or solve that problem. We have an incredible wealth of architecture knowledge, engineers, support technicians, delivery managers, and really kind of innovative consultants to help you put that stuff into play. You think about taking like all of the Lego bricks that we make in the engineering world and assembling them into Lego kits that you can go buy and go build yourself.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
And how did you get, so this is like a very specific role. Like, how did, what was your journey to this role? What brought you to consulting specifically?
Oh boy. Like historically, or just like from my last gig at Microsoft? Cause that's a lot of space.
Should we start from the very beginning?
I feel like we're getting into like metaphysical questions. Like, why are we here?
Well, I've heard there's a cool story on how you got this role. So I'd say let's start there, and then we'll go in the way back machine and learn about how Ben got into tech.
Sure. Okay. So I've been at Microsoft for 13 years. I've done a bunch of stuff, mostly in the strategic comms, consumer marketing, and fan advocacy work. I ran our worldwide retail experience business for a couple of years. I was the guy in the TV commercials and for Windows Phone, which we can talk about. I started way back in Windows. I tell everybody I had the worst job in the company. It was my first job at Microsoft. I was the enterprise PR lead for Windows Vista, which was really not awesome and hard. But immediately prior to this job, I was running a team called News Labs. News Labs was super cool. It was this idea that we had, which was, is there a way for us to use all of Microsoft's technical might and resources to help empower journalists and advance the art, science, and business of journalism, knowing that, Microsoft is the best in the world at helping to solve like those P0 kind of problems, like food supply, and clean water, and education, and healthcare. Well, access to trustworthy news and information is like right up there. If we don't have access to news sources that we can trust globally, it's going to be a bad time.
Yeah.
So we were working on that kind of stuff. We did some really neat stuff with Azure AI and a bunch of data journalism stuff around Power BI. And that led me to this role because we have a new CVP whose name is Omar Abash. He was the chief strategy officer at Accenture, brand new to the company, 7 months in, who had a vision for how we could take what is Microsoft Consulting Services and build it into something that was more on the leading edge. Like less about just implementation and delivery, more about really helping our customers envision the future. And my team was doing that for news. So it was a pretty natural fit for us to start working together.
Wow.
Really cool.
Yeah.
So something I'm kind of curious in, digging back into the trustworthy news sources, I feel like that's something that's become a really big problem, especially in the age of social media. Anybody can share anything. Mm-hmm. So how did you and your team tackle that problem?
Yeah, I mean, the challenges that the news industry are facing are like very, very far reaching. Everything from very tactical challenges like the social media echo chamber that we're all part of, to broader challenges about like ad revenue and rates are decreasing. There's this, you get into a whole like share of wallet stuff. How much, I only have so much money I can spend. Am I going to be spending it on certain places or subscriptions or advertising revenue, all the way up to like nation state tampering, right? Like, I mean, it gets really like big, big altitude stuff. But what we found is largely there were, three phases of journalism. There's the creation phase, there's the curation phase, and there's the consumption phase. Where we found the spot where we could help the most was on curation, right? Through the Microsoft News ecosystem, through MSN, Microsoft News, Bing News, all these different places. We actually, what's weird about like MSN is people view it as this kind of old, stodgy legacy brand. Actually, according to ComScore, which rates the quality of information on websites, number one news service in the world.
MSN. Really?
550 million unique users a month in 180 countries. Like it's gigantic.
Wow.
So there's that we can do to help them make money. Where I spent most of my time was on the creation phase. How do you actually empower journalists to tell trustworthy stories, do the research in a visually compelling way at a much higher velocity? So that's where things like Azure Cognitive Services started to play in. And we built this tool called IDA, the Insights and Discovery Accelerator, that effectively takes like 21 different Azure Cognitive Services and boxes it up into a drag and drop tool that you can just grab and download and just start throwing information into it. And it does entity identification, extraction, entity linking, OCRing, Bing Intelligence is built into it. There's a gazillion other things in there. But we realized, we couldn't go into a news organization that was financially struggling and be like, for the privilege of using our technology and paying us every month, I need you to pay me $1 million to go build this thing. So we built it ourselves and we gave it away. And there's some ACR, Azure Consumer Revenue and stuff on the back end. But really, it was a tool that anybody could use for a very, very low cost to help them tell more trustworthy stories more quickly. Best example is The Atlantic was kind of our launch partner. They put 150 years worth of archives into this tool to start identifying themes, trends, and entities and how they talked about them over time. So they could tell more compelling stories.
Wow. I was just literally thinking, you know, right as you said that, putting in the back issues and back articles, I was thinking, you know, before we really had news digitalized, we didn't really have the tools like this to be able to go through the news and to sort through it. So that's really, really cool that we have those capabilities and that data now that we can actually kind of have a checks and balances system with the information that we're consuming.
Yeah, it was super cool. Atlantic was really interesting because most of their archives were actually in books, like paper, like hardbound copies.
Wow.
In an archive, right? Because they started writing, I think in 1861, maybe, I think it was their first article. And then we ran into all sorts of really interesting technical challenges. Like we had to build decade specific dictionaries.
Right.
For the OCR, things like that. And decade-specific models for what words meant, not just words that showed up, because words meant different things in 1870 than they do now.
Huh.
You know, perfect example of that is like World War One. Well, when World War One was happening, they didn't call it World War One because they were hoping there wouldn't be a second one.
Right.
They called it the Great War. So you have to, if you're going to do entity linking, you have to build the model that helps it understand that the Great War and World War One are the same.
Yeah.
Same thing, different domain, different lexicons, basically. So there's
it's like dramaturgy, but for real life. So like in theater, you would have a dramaturg who would assess all of the language and make sure that, you know, everything is period and the accents are correct. It's literally that, but for machine learning. It's so fascinating.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Wow. Okay. That is so cool. And what a unique product to be able to work on while you're at Microsoft.
Yeah.
I feel like we got to figure out the path to that though, because there's a whole, you said a 12-year journey leading up to this, a whole 12 years. How did you find yourself at Microsoft then?
Oh boy. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. This is a good place to start. So I was going to be a doctor. That was my plan. I was going to be a doctor because that's what you do in my family. My dad's a doctor. Two of my uncles are doctors. Their kids are doctors. My grandfather is a doctor. It's like family business. Rudolph family business is medicine. So I was like, oh, I'll be a doctor because that's what you do. But when I went to school, when I was in school, liberal arts educations were the thing that you did if you were heading to medical school. Medical schools were like, you don't need to learn the science in college. We will teach you what you need to know. Like you should have a background and a basis in it, but you don't need to have like a chemistry degree because we'll teach you the chemistry that you need to know. Cool. So I have an art history degree from George Washington. So I was an art history guy and I studied, you know, art, and I was an Italian Renaissance focused art historian.
I love it.
Yeah.
My dad specializes in commedia dell'arte. So we had a lot of Italian art around the home.
Love it.
We love a quirky, fun degree, drama degree here. Mm-hmm. Brandon is a little bit more on the normal side with this computer science degree.
I did computer hardware engineering. So,
what a normal guy.
I thought I was going to graduate making chips for Intel and AMD, but I graduated in the middle of, well, at the beginning, I guess, of a recession. And so I got one job offer and I took it.
And smart.
Haven't done any hardware work since.
So for any folks watching out there worried that their degree is going to define the rest of their career, I think you're going to be okay.
That's right. Indeed.
Yeah. So in between my sophomore and junior year, I got a job at a biotech lab. It was actually run by two guys. So I attended and worked at a science camp for many years. It was like a summer camp and you'd go for 4 or 8 weeks. And the camp just closed, broke my heart because my son's finally old enough to go. But like my best friends in the world went to this place. And, you know, it was for like nerdy kids who didn't quite fit in. It was a great place. It's churned out some of the smartest, most accomplished people I've ever met. Like one of my very good friends that I went to camp with runs all of logistics. He's like the VP of logistics for Amazon delivery. He's that guy. And we have a bunch of people who like work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and teach astrophysics and this like crazy stuff. One guy runs, he's a very senior engineer in the Gmail team for Google. I was like, we have these very, very bright people. Wow. So two of the guys who were my camp counselors started this biotech company because they were PhDs. They started this company and I got a job with them to work in the lab. And I got to the company. The company was called Aptogen. We did some really cutting edge work on codon optimization for protein expression. So we could actually like change the DNA of a protein, like how a protein was expressed, a piece of DNA, so we could express a protein in a non-native host. Good example would be like human insulin being produced in yeast, right? Because I can't like put Chloe and Brandon in a big steel press and like squish out the insulin, but I can grow 50,000 liters of yeast that are producing insulin and squish them down, and that's how insulin gets produced. So we did that kind of stuff and some custom protein design and some really wacky.
Just super normal stuff, you know.
Super normal stuff, right? Like, what if you
could... Average summer job.
Exactly. What if you could, engineer a protein by its end function, and then we could build it for you from scratch? Super interesting.
Sounds like a Wednesday,
Yeah, right. So I worked in the lab, and I was like, I'm going to go get experience from medical school because I'm going to be a doctor. And I worked in the lab for 1 week, and it was the most boring thing I've ever done in my entire life. Because at the time... like CRISPR and things like that didn't really exist. We were running like gel electrophoresis plates, which you've ever seen, like how you actually like get a picture of DNA. You put the dye in and you use electrical current to stretch the stuff out, and it takes days.
It's not like the movies. It's not with the sound effects and the...
Right. Yeah. Right, exactly. Where somebody hits a button and we worked on the first decoding of the human genome. First mapping the human genome. And that took months. And then you like walk into London Heathrow and there's a big banner that said like, through the power of Azure, the National Institutes of Health can sequence 7 billion genomes a day. And so I was like, we've kind of moved very far down the road.
Yeah. Wow.
But I went to Colin, who was my boss at the time. And I said, I hate working in the lab. It's the most boring thing I've ever done in my life. If you make me work in the lab all summer, I'm going to like run into traffic. Like I just can't handle it.
Were there any warning signs when you started this job? Like, did you go into it thinking like, this is it? Or were you kind of like,
No, I went into it thinking it was going to be awesome. And I was going to be like working on all this really complex stuff, but like, I didn't know anything. So I couldn't do the complex stuff. And there were people there who were way smarter than me. But I had no understanding of the patients that it took to do actual scientific research, because my whole frame of reference was like TV shows and movies. Like I'd never been in a lab before in any meaningful way. I'd been in a lab.
Yeah.
I just assumed it would be more fun. It wasn't fun. So I went to Colin and I said, I've known him forever. He's known my family forever. And, through the camp. And I was basically like, look, Colin, like you got to come up with something for me to do. Like you're my job for the summer. And if you don't come up with me something for me to do, like my mom's going to kill both of us. So you better figure it out. And I remember he held up this book, and it was like one of those like MBA in a box books, because he didn't know anything either. And I think he would admit that. And he was like, well, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to raise some VC money, right? Get some investment in cash so we can hire more scientists, expand the lab, do more projects. And I was like, okay. He's like, and this book says a really great way to do that is to generate positive press, go do PR. And I was like, okay. And he's like, so go do that. And I was like, I don't know how to do that. And he's like, I don't know how to do it either. But like you said, you needed something to do for the summer. So go figure it out. So I started making my press lists and doing phone calls. And I got us this story where we were part of like this, we were basically a feature on the front page of the Los Angeles Times on, the DC area biotech. And just like the book said, we got a call from this boutique investment firm. It was like, hey, we saw that story and we'd like to talk to you about investing in the lab. And like, just like the book said, they invested and the lab was saved and we grew the lab. And Colin was like, congratulations, you're running marketing for Aptogen. So my junior and senior year, I was basically working full time and going to school full time, helping to build out this biotech lab. That's kind of like how I got derailed from the medical path. And I ended up in this like technology, like PR messaging, marketing advocacy path. And that I did my own thing for a couple of years. And then I got hooked up really early on with a company that you both may be familiar with called Parallels. If you know Parallels, the Windows and Mac virtualization.
Use it all the time.
So I was the first employee at Parallels. I was the first non-engineer at Parallels. And it was one of those things where I applied for a job at one of Parallels' sister companies, and I didn't get the job, and I was super mad. And they were like, but we're doing this other thing. A couple of engineers, they're based in Moscow. They seem really smart. They don't really have a business plan yet. Like, maybe you could help them get that started. And I was like, well, it's better than what I'm doing now. So sure, what the heck, let's do it. So I launched Parallels. I launched Parallels Desktop for Mac. And that put me on my path to Microsoft. My path to Microsoft was super weird because there was a spot in 2007, I want to say, where Microsoft changed the Windows EULA to say that you couldn't run anything other than Windows Vista Ultimate in a virtual machine.
End user license agreement.
So there was no technical reason. It was a user thing because there's, you know, this old Microsoft, there's a lot of legacy baggage there. So I got really annoyed and I wrote a blog post because it was 2007 and we had a blog because we were cutting edge. And I wrote this blog post about how it was like kind of anti-user behavior and how I didn't really like the way Microsoft was approaching it. And it got picked up in the press. And in the press, like, I mean, there were mainstream broadcast press coverage, AP, Reuters, all those kind of places. So I got summoned to Microsoft, like summoned. I got an email from somebody whose name I won't share at the time, who was like looking after licensing, and they were like, "So and so would like to meet you on campus." And I was like, "This is it. This is how it ends for me." Right?
Had a good run.
So we had this meeting and they basically said, hey, we listened to the concerns. This was like the first inklings of like good new Microsoft. We listened to the concerns. We saw the press coverage. We heard from our developers. We heard from our end users. We're going to change the EULA back to what it was. So it worked. So I got them to change the Windows license agreement for 1 billion people. Cool.
Oh my God.
It's kind of amazing, right? And like we escaped and like there were a bunch of, I was assumed we were going to get sued. We didn't get sued. It was great.
You were basically a developer advocate. Without officially being a developer advocate, you were the voice users OG. In a way.
So like that happened and that was great. We changed it. Everyone was very happy. And a couple months later, I got a call from somebody on the comms team saying, hey, we have this role, which turned out to be the worst job in the company, the enterprise PR role for Windows Vista, but it got me in. And saying, hey, you know, we like the approach. We like the human tone that you took. We want to talk to you about this job. So I kind of got recruited and now I'm here. It was a weird path. Like this was not the direction that I assumed that my career would go by any stretch of the imagination. Like, if you told me as like a kid who grew up in kind of in farm country in the middle of Pennsylvania that one day I would be living in Seattle and working for Microsoft with my art history degree, collecting dust and mud in my garage, this would not have been, something that I would predict.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I gotta say, we have comment. This is friend of the show, PJ Metz, says, is there anything Ben hasn't done? And I agree, Ben, that was an amazing story. And it seems like you have done it all and you can do it all.
Well, I don't know if I can do it all, but I've done a bunch of stuff. But it's all been kind of in the same vein, right? Of like, how do you take, for me, I mean, I'm not all my, like, I think some, you know, Chloe, I know you said you were kind of self-taught and you didn't like have a formal CS background. Like I kind of learned it myself, right? Because I was interested in it. So I picked it up as I went along. But for me, like where my happy place is, and I feel like the thing that I can do better than most people is how do you take technology and make it relatable to real humans? So I love being in retail and I love telling the stories about it and how you can win people over to be fans of the company and of the brand and make them feel like they're part of the Microsoft family, even if they don't have a blue badge or an orange badge or whatever
else. Yeah. I've been loving, I know you mentioned to me, Ben, that you know the folks behind this account, the Microsoft Twitter account. Shout out to the Microsoft Twitter account. It is constantly making me laugh, cry, get emotional. They recently celebrated Kelly Rowland's birthday. Loved that. It is, I think there's really, I totally agree. There's really something to be said for, you know, we make really cool technology and products, but when we can either make people feel something, either be it to laugh or, you know, if it's the emotions that we feel from the new Super Bowl commercial that shows our newest controller or something, there's so many ways that you can kind of affect people using the power of humor, using the power of empathy. And that's what I've really loved about this new Microsoft everyone speaks of, although I feel like I've always just been a part of the new Microsoft. So I just experienced the old Microsoft from afar.
You get to a spot where it's like, when we start telling stories about why we do things as opposed to what we do, you start connecting with people at a very different altitude. I mean, I think Microsoft, we're like amazing at telling the what's, like, this is the resolution of the new Surface Book 3 display. And this is what, you know, we got a gazillion things in Azure and they do all sorts of neat stuff. Like, we make a bunch of widgets and they come in these colors and sizes. How many would you like? We're great at that. Like, and we've been historically great at that because we're an engineering driven company. The new part of Microsoft is talking about the why. Like the Super Bowl commercial, not this year, maybe it was 2 years ago. The when everybody plays, we all win. Like that was like, that's the why commercial, right? We were talking about the adaptive controller because we were going to go sell a whole pile of them. That's not why that product was designed. It was designed because we have words on the back of our badge that are not just, you know, it's not just a phrase. Like, it's something that we live every day. And like, those of you who are Microsoft employees who are, you know, have a blue badge or an orange badge, it was very intentionally placed on the back of those badges so that every day when you took the physical action of badging into a building, you connected with the message. Like, that was a very intentional piece of design that was done. You know, and we start telling stories about why we make that real, and people fall in love with the brand for good reason, because we're doing the right thing, not just making the best products.
That's right. Just like Philip PJ was saying in the comments, says it's all about the human connection.
Absolutely.
Ah, I have to ask, because I myself have an arts degree. You have an art history degree. I get asked all the time by folks, do you use your degree in your day-to-day life? And I will say, as someone who took a bunch of very strange theater and movement classes, sometimes it pops up in very interesting, strange ways. But Ben, I'd be curious, with an art history degree, for maybe some folks who are joining us who have a more traditional computer science degree, do you use pieces of that? I would imagine in some form it pops up here and there, maybe not directly.
Yeah, I do use it almost every day. What I loved about art history, even compared to some other liberal arts, is that art history is kind of all encompassing, right? If you're going to learn it, there's the technical component of how art is created, right? Whether it's major arts or minor arts, but then there's the political context in which it was created, the military context it was created, where, you know, technology and trade was, what diseases were happening, right? If you take a look at art from like when the Black Plague was happening, it's very different than art in like the 15th century and where all that stuff happened, or 16th century. So there's a broader, just kind of broad-based education that allowed me to start thinking contextually about, you know, not just the thing that's in front of me, but all the pieces that connect and all the rings of concentricity around it that influence what that thing is. From a technical standpoint, I will say, and I'm going to put this on the table, I am world-class at PowerPoint. world-class. You need a deck done, I'm your guy.
It's an art. It truly is an art.
It is an art, right? And it's my canvas. And there is a storytelling lens to that, right? How you architect the story. Then there's also an aesthetic piece to that. And there's a whole, you know, color paletting and color theory and aesthetic theory and composition, all this stuff that I learned very, very deeply, that weirdly, if you are painting a fresco on the side of a church, or you are trying to convey something to a customer or to a partner, the design language is not that dissimilar. It's actually very, very close. Like, good design is good design, whether you're taking a picture or whether you're painting something or whether you're trying to convey it through a digital medium like PowerPoint. I use it more than I would think, you know, and I find it in my daily life too. I'm a photographer, that all of that stuff around sfumato and chiaroscuro and how light balances and rule of threes and all that kind of thirds and how you do great composition and design, it actually helps when you're taking pictures with like an iPhone or your Galaxy Note or whatever. So yeah, I use it pretty regularly.
Wow.
I love that. And I love how you you mentioned telling stories, because as somebody myself who grew up in Orlando, I worked a bunch of jobs at Disney, and that's something Disney's really good at, is everything has a story. They don't just build a ride. Like, you might go to the parks and you might just look at it and say, oh, that's a roller coaster. But to Disney, there's a whole backstory of,
yep,
like, why does this, like, where did this come from? How did it get here? Why does it exist? What's going to happen? What's the resolution?
Right.
And that's something that I bring to my day job. And it's funny because I always try to tell that story anytime I'm giving a presentation, anytime I'm talking at a conference, blog post. And it's something that when I first say it to folks, you kind of get that, huh? Where I'm like, it's like, okay, yeah, like, cool, you taught me how to do this in C#, but what's the story? And it's just, instead of being very dry and analytical, like step one, step two, step three, it's like, why are you doing this? What's the background? And also, how is this going to help me? Like, how can I apply this?
Right.
Like, this might be really cool knowledge, but if I don't know how to then take it and work with it in my day job, then what's the point? So yeah, what's your story? We shall be telling stories.
At Disney, of all companies, like, they're one of my favorite companies, not just from a content perspective, but from an operational perspective. They may have talked to you about this when you worked at Disney, but have you heard of their four keys? Let's talk about the Disney's four keys.
Ooh, it's been a while. Remind us.
So Disney has this operating principle. Whenever they build or do anything around their kind of like hierarchy of values of how they approach that story or that product. And those four keys are safety, courtesy, experience, and efficiency.
Okay.
And what's really interesting is that when they are building that roller coaster, they never compromise something higher on the list for something lower on the list. So when you are building, I don't know, what's the...
Rock and Roller Coaster.
Thank you. I was like, the Disney ride, right? Whatever that thing is, right? The Incredicoaster. Like, they could probably make that ride a little bit more fun, but it might be a little less safe, and they would never do that. Mm-hmm. Or they could probably make the ride a little bit shorter for the sake of efficiency, but then the experience goes down. So they would never do that. And I love, as I think about campaigns that we build, stories that we tell, and now that I'm in an operational role looking after any of these 10,000 people, what are the values that we try to instill across our org and across the company? And what are those operational hierarchy of principles that we build to make sure that we always keep our eye on the things that are most important? You know, for when we were working in news, trust and transparency was number one, right? How we are presenting news to people so that it is trusted and trustworthy, and transparency about how data was used, about how we monetize, about which news sources we work with. Because if we compromise that just one little bit, we just become one of the other guys that you can't trust. And if that thing falls apart, customers don't trust you, partners don't trust you, industry orgs don't trust you, and it starts to eat away at the brand and that mission of empowerment that we've built. So that's I've always admired Disney because they so very rarely ever compromise those four principles. Like, they are very zealous about making sure that they stick to that across everything they do and say.
And it's authentic. I think it really shows, like, when you prioritize the right things in your product or your messaging or whatever you're doing. I see a lot of folks when they're doing content kind of think of this spoonful of sugar technique where it's like, hey, come over here. Here's some clickbait. Like, come over here. But being responsible while doing that is a whole other piece of the puzzle.
Being responsible is hard, right?
Yeah.
It's like I told you, I have seven kids, right? It's hard, right? If you could be responsible, it's like, it would be easier to just like plunk them in front of the TV or an Xbox all day, but that would be bad parenting. So like, right. you have to focus on preparing them for the world. And sometimes that's hard. And sometimes that means making tough decisions. And the same thing applies in our day-to-day working environments, right?
Speaking of tough decisions, prioritization. With that, how are you thinking about work-life balance, Ben? This is you just dropped a fact on everyone. You had how many kids?
Seven, almost eight.
That's bigger than the Brady Bunch.
Number eight on the way. Congrats.
Mm-hmm. Congrats.
Thank you.
How do you deal with work-life balance as a dad and working full-time and every, as PJ mentioned in our chat, everything that you do?
Right. It's very carefully is how I manage it. It's interesting. It's, you know, when you, especially we've got a, you know, we have an unusually large family compared to most people. There are families that we know that have more kids than that. We have a family friend that they have 12. And then I start thinking about it. I tell my wife, I'm like, we're only 2/3 of the way there. Think about that. Like, put it in that context. That's
two family Von Trapps. You could have two different singing groups.
12 kids. It's amazing and wonderful. It makes me hyperventilate a little bit. For me, it's, you know, I've realized the more kids we have that we, you know, it's cliche to be like, shouldn't live to work. We should work to live. That's really become true for our family. I love my job. I will put 100% into it every day. I still probably work too many hours, especially at night and on the weekend. So what I've done is I've carved out time in my day that's family time. And that time is immutable and unbreakable. For me, that's 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning when the kids are getting up and getting ready for school. I won't do, even with a global team, I'll do calls at 6. I'll get up early. I'll do calls late at 11 o'clock at night if you need me to. But I won't do a call from 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning and from about 5:30 to 8 at night. That's dinner time. That's bath time. That's homework time. That's bedtime. Afterwards, you know, I will, if I need to, get back online. So what I've basically created with my team, and I've encouraged them to do the same, is I've created like a red, yellow, green chart for the day. These are times when I am available. These are times when I'm available if you absolutely need me. These are times when I am not available. And something's kind of amazing has happened. And I encourage all of you to try it. And I've encouraged my team to try it too. When you tell people no with a good reason, they tend to be okay with it. It's like we live in a world where we get really nervous, like, oh, Chloe needs me to talk at 7 o'clock in the morning. And like, I don't, it's going to be a thing and she's going to get mad. And what happens to my job? And then we catastrophize. It's like, and then I'll be living, you know, I'll lose the house and we'll be rolling with all my kids and all these kind of things. That's probably, it might happen. Probably not. Right. But in reality, it's, hey, Chloe, I can't meet from 7 to 8. That's the time when I'm getting my kids ready. Can we either meet before or after? I found most times people say, yeah, no problem. Sure. I'll move it. Or even better, don't worry about it. I got it covered. Like, that's the best answer. Yes, you got it covered.
I needed to hear this. I am such an obliger when it comes to like accountability with other people. So I'm the one going through all the scenarios in my head. But I'm such a yes and girl. I need to learn no and. Here's why.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like, for, you know, I'm not going to get into all my deep rooted psychological issues about why I need to please people and all that kind of stuff. It's a different episode. But you know, I'm the same way, right? It's like, I want people to know that I'm there for them and that I'm committed to my job. But what I've realized, the older I get, the more experienced I get, as my kids need and require and want more time with me, that, you know, like, I have to be just as accountable to my family, or more accountable to my family. And by extension, more accountable to myself. And, you know, what I've done is I have those times blocked in my calendar. And if I need to start early, if I've got a 5:30 a.m. call, I slide my end of day up till 3 o'clock or 3:30 and I'm just done. And I force myself to be offline. Because if I don't, I am the kind of person where I'll be on from 5:30 in the morning until 6:30 at night. Then I'm like in a crummy mood for my kids. I'm not being a good husband to my wife. I'm not being a good, you know, steward of our household. Like, all the things that I need to do outside of work, I don't have anything left in the tank for it. And you know, you don't want to short sell your kids. Like, they need that time. They need you to be present, not just be present in the room, but actually be like emotionally present. So yeah, I mean, there's no magic bullet to it for sure. But that's like, for me, it's just like clear boundaries on starts of day and ends of day has been hugely helpful for me.
I don't even have kids and I feel like I need to do that for myself, just for my own mental health. Sometimes I just have to block out 2 hours to play Animal Crossing and this is my time to recharge, you know. And I think during a global Panera, as I'm calling it, we forget that we're stuck at home and we're not doing as many things for ourselves lately. So yeah, I'm like, I'm writing everything down. I'm like, oh yes, saying no, do that more.
It's incredibly, saying no, like strategically saying no to people is highly empowering. Because there's like no when you're being a jerk. Like, hey, can you help me with this thing? No. Right. Then you're like, that guy. Don't be that guy. But if you're like, no, because of these, like, because like, hey, I can't right now because I've got family things. Like today, when I wrap this stream with you, my daughter plays softball. And Wednesday afternoons, I coach softball. So like I'm off at 2:30. And everybody knows that. When I said that to everybody, hey, I won't be reachable from about 2:30 until about 5. Nobody was like, how dare you? Like, everyone was like, oh, cool. That's awesome.
Coach
like,
maybe Ben.
Go do that. Right. And, you know, hopefully we all have teams, competent teams of people, whether they be direct reports or, you know, virtual team members or people we rely on. You can kind of like disperse the work. Like it'll be there waiting for you in the morning. I promise.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, speaking of, I'll say hobbies, we were chatting before the show started, Ben, and you also mentioned, you, correct me if I'm wrong, taught Krav Maga?
I did. So I'm a certified Krav Maga instructor. I got certified in 2002. I have a black belt in jiu-jitsu that I earned in 2005. And I spent a number of years teaching self-defense, close-quarter combatives to civilians. But I did a lot of work in the D.C. area with law enforcement and with military as well. So it was just something I enjoyed. I found out that I was pretty good at it. Spent a couple of weeks in Florida and then in Los Angeles and other places kind of getting beat up by a bunch of former Israeli commandos, got certified. But it's something I really enjoy doing. And I feel like it's a critical life skill for all of us. Like I wish that it wasn't. I wish we lived in a world where nobody ever needed to do that. Unfortunately, not the case. And Chloe, you and I had a thread about that with a couple of months ago at this point. But like,
yeah,
being aware of your surroundings and know how to handle yourself in case of emergency is something that everybody should be empowered to do.
Yeah. And I know I super appreciated it. I was just going to say, as a woman online, these are things that I think about quite a bit. So once I learned, you put some great tips. I'll share the thread after this stream. But I was doing a thread, Brandon, about how I'm always very paranoid of the reflection in my glasses, or I always post photos a lot later so people can't track my location. And I've gotten off apps like Swarm that deal a lot with like check-in and location-based things. And I think there's so much knowledge to not only be learned about how to keep yourself safe online, but also physically, that I'm going to reach out to you, Ben, for some tips and tricks on where to learn.
You know, from my perspective, like I have an incredible just like natural privilege in the fact that like I'm 6'1", I weigh 200 pounds, I'm highly trained, I shave my head, I kind of look angry all the time. Like it's not intentional, but like the
words
like,
are you angry?
Yeah, I was like, are you angry? Like I'm like, this is how my face looks. I don't know what to tell you. But like I'm not the guy that feels threatened in most places. You know, people generally leave me alone. Like I'm not a target. But that's not the case for everybody. And like you can overcome that through training and awareness. So that's always been something that I've just really enjoyed because it felt like it was a way for me to take that kind of natural ability and kind of natural privilege that I have and help scale it out to those who don't have it naturally.
Ah, Brandon, we got to get you in some classes.
I did, and I'm absolutely not at the level little Ben is, so I won't even pretend. I did. I took a couple of Krav Maga classes a couple of years ago, but only stuck with it for a couple months. And yeah, you can make an excuse for everything. And mine in this case was traveling too much to have that monthly, to justify the monthly membership,
sure,
where I could only do a couple classes a month. But I really enjoyed it. And I think the thing I enjoyed the most about Krav Maga is it's not necessarily, well, it's all defensive. My takeaway was you want to get out of Dodge as fast as possible. So where are exits? Make sure you position yourself between the attacker and the exit. And if you can avoid the fight and just get out. And that's one thing I really appreciated, because I think when a lot of folks think of martial arts, you kind of think of, oh, I'm going to become,
they think
this
of the
crazy
Ninja Turtles, like my shirt. Like,
I'm going to go fight crime, right? It's like, no, like this is all very much self-defense. Like you don't want to do anything that you shouldn't have to. And so I really appreciate that. And yeah, anytime I'm out, like when I'm walking the dog at night and I see or feel kind of that that feeling that we've all felt. I run through the training, but yeah. Thankfully I've never been in a situation where I've needed it. So
I would say like on that piece, like if you get that feeling, like listen to that feeling. That usually means something is wrong. And if you take a defensive measure, you move to the other side of the street, you go to some place that's more lit and there is nothing there. Like, so what? Like you did the, you did the right thing. But yeah, it's like, I would say Krav is like what I loved about it was it was real heavy on the martial and real light on the art. It's highly practical.
Love that.
And they teach you how to effectively defend against very common attacks in very repeatable ways. The actual number of techniques that you learn is surprisingly small compared to like when I was studying jiu-jitsu, which took years and years and years to learn. Very, very intricate, highly specialized techniques, much more artistic, that you can use in common situations. And they train you to be aware. Like you made a great point, like making sure that you stay in well-lit areas, understanding what's going on around you. You know, there are even these things now, like if I'm in a restaurant, I don't like having my back to the door. You know, they're like these things that you just get trained to kind of do in your day-to-day life. You know, I stand sideways when I'm at an ATM so I can kind of see what's going on around me when I'm like otherwise focused. And you learn these kind of techniques that just give you a better understanding of what's going on around you. Because especially in the smartphone age, it's very easy to get lost in that little piece of glass and completely block out everything that's going around you. And, you know, that is when people start to view you as a target.
Yeah, I feel like my awareness is like up here because I lived in San Francisco for so many years and then I'll go visit family in Tucson or in Texas and I'm like, you're putting your purse on the back of the chair? Oh my gosh, like, it's gonna get stolen.
Yeah, I, even in my neighborhood, we live in a very safe neighborhood. I make sure I lock my car every night because I lived in DC for a long time, like downtown DC. And it's like, you would never leave your car unlocked. That's a terrible idea.
I get scared just thinking about my laptop back in coffee shops back in the day. I do. So many ways to. Oh my goodness. Well, I just heard a very interesting magical Disney sound in the background, which I think is a really good transition to how we usually close out the show, Ben, which we usually talk about theme parks. And I heard a very Disney-like sound in the background. So I'm thinking you're probably a Disney household as well. Are you?
We are. Did you hear it on my side? Is that where you heard the sound?
I want to say I did. I used to be a nanny, so I know these sound interludes, these magical tinkling sounds.
You're close. There are two, my five-year-old and my three-year-old, I think are playing Minecraft Dungeons right outside of the
school. Okay.
So it's close. I heard the noise when the, you know, like the arch-illager shows up. So I think that's where they are.
I got very excited.
We do a lot of Disney in this house for sure. So we have five girls, two boys. So my five-year-old, my three-year-old are in like, they're like deep in princess mode right now, for sure. So yes, we have seen the movies a couple of times.
We're talking Frozen, probably. I'm thinking
we really enjoy Frozen. We do a lot of Frozen. I think that's still probably the number one. We do a lot of Moana.
Okay.
Those are great movie, amazing soundtrack. What else have they been watching recently?
Have you all watched Soul yet?
We watched Soul. I enjoyed Soul. It was really good. So
how does one travel to a theme park with that many children? I imagine that's an Olympic sport in a way.
You don't. That's what we did. So like, we've actually never taken all of them. And it's largely been because like, it's so logistically complex for sure. That we take the kids when they are older. So like my older kids have been twice and we kind of like add new kids as they get into the age. But like five has generally been our threshold. Because before that, it's like they're in strollers all day and like they get tired really easily. And there's like a lot of gear and like workarounds. Like if anybody's in the nap time kind of phase, that's like not conducive to maximizing your Disney investment, which is
a very expensive nap.
Right. So we're like the family that like we're there when the park opens and we're just like, we just power through because it's expensive. So I think the most we've taken is four. We've done four kids. So two parents, four kids. Been logistically fine. We had a trip planned. And then obviously when the pandemic hit, we scratched it. Because with all the travel that I do, I have like 1.9 million Alaska miles to spend. So like we can get them there pretty easily. It's just, you know, managing them.
Do you have a personal favorite theme park? Maybe pre-kids? Are you a roller coaster fan? You got a favorite ride? These are the tough questions we ask on this show.
Yeah. So I think the original Disneyland is my favorite, mainly because like my uncle, one of the ones who's a doctor, he's a plastic surgeon at Scripps in San Diego. So we would go visit them, and then we would go to, we'd drive up to Anaheim, and we'd go to Disneyland. Favorite ride? Oh my gosh. It's been, let's see.
I too am a Disneyland fan, although have not ventured to Disney World yet. That'll be a 2035 trip.
Disney World is, I was down there for I did a conference with the Disney Consulting Institute where that's where you kind of like learn how they do their operations and all that kind of stuff. I forgot how big that place is. It's like 60 square miles they own in the middle of, it's shockingly big.
Massive. It's own county.
We did I did a thing at Disneyland as part of the Disney Consulting Institute where they said the parking lot at Disney World is bigger than Disneyland.
Oh my gosh.
Like Disneyland is like 350 acres or something.
Wow. And
the parking lot at like the Magic Kingdom is like 500 acres.
That like, is giant.
It is they operate at a scale. They said, I forget the exact number. They said the next biggest theme park outside of Disneyland, the Disney Worlds, like small W. Disney World does the volume they do in a year in, I think they said 3 days.
Oh my gosh. Like
it's bananas how many people they move through those
That's
places.
That's a lot of churros and turkey legs for a lot of people.
But weirdly, like the number one reason people say they go back to Disney, safety. They feel safe, even with all those people. Hmm. And the number two reason is cleanliness. So it's like when you do like really serious experience design, they index on the emotional connection of I feel safe, this place is spotless, everybody is nice, and I am happy to pay $15 for a churro and wait in line for 3 hours to get on what's the cars, the racing ride.
Oh yeah.
Cars. No, not test ride. This is the one in Disneyland that's part of Radiator Springs Racers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you'll be happy to wait 3 hours and eat your turkey leg in the blistering heat because you feel safe and it's clean.
Yeah. Disney magic really is a real thing. I truly believe that, having worked for the Mouse briefly, there's something, I think it really comes back to what we talked about at the start of the show about creating that experience and that like empathy and that familiarness that makes you comfortable enough to spend that much money on an experience.
Absolutely right. When you think about the emotional connection they drive. So here's my Disney story. Like I would talk about that's my favorite one. Radiator Springs Racers. That's my favorite. I thought like that one is phenomenal. But like, well, the first time we went to Disneyland, my oldest daughter she has some sensory issues, right? Really hates loud noises, always has. So we're there. It's me, my wife, my oldest son, and my oldest daughter. And we stayed for the fireworks. And my oldest daughter like lost it. Like she was having like anxiety, like overspill, right? She was just like not in a good spot. So we bailed out, and I think we went into Adventureland, and we just like ducked into one of the stores, and she was like hyperventilating and freaking out. And like this woman who was a cashier there, she was like working the register, like closed her register and like came over and like found a quiet spot between two racks of sweatshirts for Audrey to sit and gave her like a pin, like just like off the rack, like didn't cost anything. It was like a $15 pin, just like stuck it on her and like took care of her. And she didn't have to do that. But the fact that they empower their people to do the right thing, because nobody leaves Disneyland unhappy. Like, that's the thing. It's like, we sell happiness here. And if you're not happy, we will do what we can to fix that. Was like, that was like a, not just a storytelling moment, but like a, this is how you deal with humans moment. Yeah. I think we do a pretty good job of that now. But there's still work for us to do for sure.
I love that. I love that story.
Beautiful story. Now we have less than a minute left, Ben. I wish we could talk to you for many more hours, but thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell people where they can find you.
So my Twitter handle's up on screen, Ben the PC guy. Come say hi. I'm on too much. Probably talking to Chloe. So I'll be around. So if you have any questions or anything, say hi and happy to answer. Yeah.
And we'll have you back on the show soon, Ben.
Love to.
We'll have to be a return guest.
Love to.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us today. And we will see you next week with another extra special guest. Bye, y'all.